Okay. We're going to read Blood, a Southern Fantasy by Michael Moorcock. This was written and published in 1994. It's got a note here. Parts of this novel were first published in slightly different form in New Worlds magazine, edited by David Garnett, over the kind of earlier couple of years. I'm slightly trepidatious because this is an extremely experimental novel, but in my estimation, one of the best novels ever written. The chapters are very short, so I'll do a couple of chapters in a row. I apologise now for my lack of French. I won't be making any more apologies. A lot of the chapters are titled in French. I would like to be able to do this as a full radio play, but obviously that's not possible. I'll try to do some different voices, but keep it tasteful. And if you come across parts of the novel that make no sense, just know that it will return to the kind of main plot line to the degree that there is such a thing. In the next chapter. Okay, let's begin. To the memory of Angela Carter, a generous heart, a brilliant mind, and a great talent, and for Mark and Alex, good friends. Quoting Milton's Paradise Lost. The Imperial Ensign, which full high advanced, shone like a meteor streaming to the wind, with gems and golden lustre rich emblazed, seraphic arms and trophies, all the while sonorous metal blowing martial sounds, at which the universal host upsent, a shout that tore hell's concave, and beyond frighted the reign of chaos and old night. All in a moment through the gloom were seen 10,000 banners rise into the air, with orient colours waving. With them rose a huge forest of spears, and thronging helms appeared, and serried shields in thick array of depth immeasurable. Part 1. Colour. Prologue. A year or two ago, I inherited the manuscripts of Edwin Begg, the famous Clapham Antichrist, whom I had known since the 1960s. The miscellany of typescript and crudely handmade magazines was at first entirely incomprehensible to me. It looked like the remains of a psychedelic undergraduate project which had very properly been abandoned. Although I am known for my skills as an editor of others' work, the Begg collection seemed at first impossible. Yet I was duty-bound to prepare the papers for press and seek a publisher for them. I am doomed, I am beginning to understand, to remain a kind of eternal editor. However, as I worked on the manuscript, I began to perceive its coherence. A complex and intriguing story emerged as all the disparate elements came together to form an unfamiliar whole. The world described in Begg's papers was not our own, nor did it appear to know of our own. It was a world in which the white races had fallen into decadence and other races had risen to build a more dynamic civilization. When the colour spots had started to appear, they were regarded as a boon, a source of free, apparently limitless energy. Raw energy, which could be harnessed and used for almost any electronic purpose, but little else. Seeking further colour, as the world's other resources diminished, engineers determined to drill to what they believed to be the source of a great colour mass which had erupted one afternoon in the ocean off the port and resort of Biloxi, Mississippi, and for a while provided enough electronic fuel for the whole state and much of Louisiana. They were boring into what the engineers defined as ultra-reality, the source matter of the universe, but they drilled for only seconds before the famous fault emerged like a gin from a bottle, swallowing platform crews, the pier, some beachfront buildings, gambling boats, and part of the onshore monitoring section, even as they aborted the project. All matter, living or inert, was gulped up by that hungry, uncontrollable fault, raging and howling like a million souls in torment, vivid against the unnaturally tranquil ocean and a still southern sky. From then on, the process was irreversible. It seemed the fabric of reality shredded and warped, growing almost senile in its whimsicalities. Amongst the few able to survive and thrive in such uncertain conditions were the so-called Yugadors, also known as Mucamirim, or more familiarly, Chocareros, forming the famous gambler guilds, whose adepts played in every way for the very highest stakes, who counted up their sacred duty to take risks and did so as a matter of honour and habit, staking their lives and reputations casually. They were called Yugadors, according to the patois of the day, which had developed mostly from Carib, French, Spanish, African, and English sources. They knew how to calculate odds and make decisions in a world increasingly ruled by chance. While held in superstitious suspicion by many, the Yugadors and Yugadoritas were the aristocratic adepts of their world, and respected by the most rapacious warlords, white or black. They looked to Africa for their models, their art, their intellectual inspiration, their morality, and to some degree their religion. Those who had been trained in the great teaching casinos of Cairo and Marrakech were the most respected Mucamirim. These travelled freely across disputed territories and traditionally dominated the riverboats that had again become an important means of travel. The planet grew increasingly unstable, touched by a vast manifestation of chaos revealed through the Biloxi Fault. Decaying energy produced sudden flurries of power blazing with an unhealthy intensity before they were tapped or disappeared. The effects of entropy were everywhere. Sometimes these effects were spectacular, miraculous, and uncomfortably alien, the stuff of hectic nightmare or ecstatic vision. Few believed the Earth would ever be healed of her physical or her metaphysical wounds. It became clear that soon the planet must perish and death consume all memory. Perhaps fearing this inevitable end, many placed increasing value on the moment, learning to relish every remaining second of life. Amongst these were Jack Caraquasian and Kalinda De Vero, who were considered by many to be the king and queen of their calling, both Yugadors of the highest caliber, the admiration and envy of their peers, the moral exemplars of all aspirants. They were lovers, and their story is told here. This is also the story of Sam Okenhurst and that mysterious woman who claimed to be half animal and half plant and was known as the Rose. Mr. Okenhurst's appetites and pastimes had become, some would say, neurotic and perverse, but his love for the Rose was as honest and enthusiastic as any emotion he had ever known. Her love for him was, some think, not entirely selfless. Two pairs of lovers, famous gamblers all, even when chaos threatened to engulf the multiverse, when the entire quasi-infinite was in upheaval. They staked their mortal lives and their immortal souls against all the forces of singularity, that deadly alternative, refusing the trap of simplification and reduction. This is a love story. It is also an adventure story. It is a tale of blind devotion, honest faith, and wild risk. About honour, about codes, and about a game in which the most valuable stakes are individual human souls, and the prizes are all those realities for which the human spirit longs. Until the events described in the story, these realities remained unattainable. This is also a story about good luck and bad, which can never be predicted. Though Jack Karakwazian made the most of his luck, and in the end, it might be argued, even Sam Okenhurst found a form of redemption. As for the Rose, she has many titles. In Muhrenberg, she was the Countess von Beck, but in Tenerlorn she had another name, as she had in Paris, London, New York, and Los Angeles. And in Sporting Club Square, Hammersmith, where I lived for several years, she was remembered as an angel. I came to know her almost as well as I knew Una Persson, who was otherwise a very different personality. Everything about the Rose is mysterious, even her true biological makeup. Sometimes I think that she is mad, a visionary blinded by the blaze of her own imaginings. But she's too involved with others to be truly mad. I know that she weeps for the world's pain, and it is this sorrow, if anything, which informs her actions. Nonetheless, there are many men who hate her with a passion I find disturbing. Though her motives are complex, she has a great heart. Her enemies say she calculates too coldly, that she is a gamer without peer, but a gamer without mercy. I have had a glimpse of the stakes she plays for and the risks she takes. It is altruism and hatred which help determine her actions as she moves between the spaces, separating each universe from the other, walking the moonbeams between one reality and the next. The spaces which are the rich and glamorous roads uniting the worlds. There never was a woman, says Hwaeldraeth, as free as the Rose. Signed, Michael Moorcock, Hjokmok, Arctic, Lapland, 24th of December, 1993. Quoting Lobkowitz, "The very nature of our dreams is changing. We have deconstructed the universe and are refusing to rebuild it. This is our madness and our glory. Now we can again begin the true course of our explorations without preconceptions or agendas." Chapter 1, A Victim of the Game. The heat of the New Orleans night pressed against the window like an urgent lover. Jack Karakwazian stood sleepless, naked, staring out into the sweating darkness as if he might see at last some tangible horror which he could confront and even hope to conquer. "Tomorrow," he told his handsome friend Sam Okenhurst, "I shall take the Star up to Natchez and from there make my way to McClellan by way of the Trace. Will you come?" The vision of a sunlit bayou, recollection of an extraordinarily rich perfume, the wealth of the earth. He remembered the yellow-billed herons standing in the shadows, moving their heads to regard him with thoughtful eyes before returning their respect to the water. The grey ibises seeming to sit in judgment of the others. The delicate egrets congregating on the old logs and branches. A cloud of monarch butterflies, black and orange, diaphanous, settling over the pale reeds, and in the dark green waters a movement might have been copperhead or alligator or even a pike. In that moment of silence before the invisible insects began a fresh song, her eyes were humorous and inquiring. She had worked for a while, she said, as a chanteuse at the Fallen Angel on Bourbon Street. Well, Sam Oakenhurst understood the invitation to be a courtesy. I think not, Jack. My luck has been running pretty badly lately, and travelling ain't likely to improve it much. Wiping his ebony fingers against his undershirt, he delicately picked an ace from the bays of his folding table. For a moment, the overhead fan, fueled by some mysterious power, stirred the cards. Pausing, Mr. Oakenhurst regarded this phenomenon with considerable satisfaction, as if his deepest faith had been confirmed. Besides, I got all the mung I need right now. And he patted his belt, full of hard guineas, better than muscle. It looked for a moment as if our energy had come back. Mr. Karakwazian got onto his bed and sat there, undecided whether to try sleeping or to talk. I'm also planning to give the game a rest. I swear it will be a while before I play at the terminal. They both smiled. You still looking at California, Jack? Mr. Oakenhurst stroked down a card. And the free states? Well, maybe eventually, Jack Karakwazian offered his attention back to the darkness while a small, dry, controlled cough shook his body. He cursed softly and vigorously and went to pour himself a careful drink from the whiskey on the table. You should do it, said Mr. Oakenhurst. Nobody knows who you are anymore. I left some unfinished business between Starkville and McClellan. Quietly satisfied by this temporary victory over his disease, the gambler drew in a heavy breath. And anywhere's better than this. Sam, I'll go in the morning as soon as they sound the upboat siren. Putting down the remaining cards, his partner rose to cross through sluggish shadows, the unpolished floor, and beneath the fluttering swamp cone on the wall, pry up one of the boards. He removed a packet of money and divided it in two without counting it. There's your share of Texas. Brother Ignatius and I agreed if only one of us got back, you'd have half. Jack Karakwazian accepted the bills and slipped them into a pocket of the black silk jacket which hung over the other chair on top of his pants, his linen and brocaded vest. It's rightfully all yours, Sam, and I'll remember that. Well, who knows how our luck will run, but it will be a sad year down here, I think, win or lose. Mr. Karakwazian found it difficult to express most emotions. For too long his trade had depended on hiding them. Yet he was able to lay a pale, fraternal hand on his friend's shoulder, a gesture which meant a great deal more to both than any amount of conversation. His eyes, half hidden behind long lashes, became gentle for a moment. Both men blinked when suddenly the darkness outside was ripped by a burst of fire, of flickering arsenical greens and yellows, of vivid scarlet sparks. The mechanish squealed and wailed as if in torment, while other metallic lungs uttered loud, suppressed groans, occasionally interrupted by an aggressive bellow. A shriek of despair from xylonite vocal cords, or a deeper, more threatening klaxon as the steel militia, their bodies identified by bubbling globules of burning, dirty orange plastic, gouting black smoke, roamed the narrow streets in search of flesh, human or otherwise, which had defied the city's intolerable curfew. Mr. Karakwazian had never slept well in New Orleans. The fundamental character of the authority appalled him. Chapter 2. Two of a Kind. At dawn, as the last of the garishly decorated, popishly baroque mechanish blundered over the cobbles of the Rue Dauphine, spreading their unwholesome ichor behind them, Jack Karakwazian carried his carpet bag to the quayside, joining other men and women making haste aboard L'Etoile de Memphis, anxious to leave the oppressive terrors of a quarter where the colour-greedy Machinois, their that brutal aristocracy allowed only their engines the freedom of the streets. Compared to the conscious barbarism of the machines, the riverboat's cream filigree Gothic was in spare good taste, and Mr. Caraquasian ascended the gangplank with his first-class ticket in his hand, briefly wishing he were going all the way to the capital, where at least some attempt was made to maintain old standards. But duty, according to Jack Caraquasian's idiosyncratic morality, and the way in which he identified an abiding obsession, had to be served. He had sworn himself that he must perform a particular task and obtain certain information before he could permit himself any relief, any company other than Kalinda de Vero's. He followed an obsequious steward along a familiar colonnaded deck to the handsomely carved door of the stateroom he favoured when in funds. By way of thanks for a generous tip, he was offered a knowing leer and the murmured intelligence that a high-class snow frail was travelling in the adjoining suite. Mr. Caraquasian rewarded this with a scowl and a sharp oath, so that the steward left before, as he clearly feared, the tip was snatched back from his fingers. Shaking his head at the irredeemable vulgarity of the white race, Mr. Caraquasian unpacked his own luggage. The boat shuddered suddenly as she began to taste her steam, her paddle wheel stirring the dark waters of the Mississippi. Compared to the big ocean-going schooner on which long ago the gambler had crossed from Alexandria, the Etoile was comfortingly reliable and responsive. For him, she belonged to an era when time had been measured by chronometers rather than degrees of deliquescence. He was reminded against his guard of the first day he had met the adventuress Kalinda de Vero, who had been occupying those same adjoining quarters and following the same calling as himself. Dancing defiantly with her on deck in the summer night amongst the mosquito lamps to the tune of an accordion, a fiddle, a dobro and a bass guitar, while the second officer, Mr. Piter, sang Poor Hobo in a sweet baritone. Oh, pauvre hobo, mon petit Pierrot. Ah, foolish hope, my grief, mon soir. Ay, no longer Houston, but our passion never she resolves. Allons danser, allons danser. The old traditional elegies, the pain of inconstancy. La musique, ma tristesse. They were dancing. They were told in turn with a sort of death. But the oracles whom the fashion favoured in those days, and who swarmed the same boats as Caraquasian and his kind, were of proven inaccuracy. Even had they not been, Caraquasian and Mrs. de Vero could have done nothing else than what they did, for theirs was at that time an ungovernable chemistry. As it happened, the white woman kept entirely to her stateroom, and all Caraquasian knew of her existence was an occasional overheard word to her stewardess. Seemingly, her need for solitude matched his own. He spent the better part of the first 48 hours sleeping, his nightmares as troubled as his memories. When he woke up, he could never be sure whether he had been dreaming or remembering, but he was almost certain he had shouted out at least once. Horrified by the thought of what he might reveal, he dosed himself with laudanum until only his snores disturbed the darkness. Yet he continued to dream. Her name, she had said, was West African or Irish in origin. She was not sure. They had met for the second time in the terminal cafe on the stablest edge of the Biloxi Fault. The cafe's sharply defined walls constantly jumped and mirrored, expanding space, contracting it, slowing time, frantically dancing in and out of a thousand mirror matrixes. Its neon sign, Last Heat on the Beach, usually lavender and cerise, drawing power directly from the howling chaos a few feet away, between the white sand and the blue ocean, where all the unlikely geometries of the multiverse, all the terrible wild colours, that maelstrom of uninterpretable choices, were displayed in a smooth, perfect circle, which the para-engineers had sliced through the core of all time and all space, its rim edged by a rainbow ribbon of vanilla-scented crystal. Usually, the terminal cafe occupied roughly the area of space filled by the old pier, which itself had been absorbed by the vortex during the early moments of an experiment intended to bore into the very marrow of ultra-reality and extract all the energy the planet needed. The operation had been aborted 22 seconds after it began. Since then, adventurers of many persuasions and motives had made the sidestep through the oddly coloured flames of the fault into that inferno of a billion perishing space-time continua, drawn down into a maw which sucked to nothingness the substance of whole races and civilizations, whole planetary systems, whole histories, while Earth and Sun bobbed in some awkward and perhaps temporary semi-parasitical relationship between the feeding and the food. Their position in this indecipherable matrix being generally considered a fluke, or perhaps the planet was the actual medium of this destruction, as untouched by it as the knife which cuts the throat of the Easter lamb. Even the least fanciful of theorists agreed that they might have accelerated, or at least were witness to, a universal destruction. They believed the engineers had drilled through unguessable dimensions, damaging something which had until now regulated the rate of entropy to which human senses had over millions of years evolved. With that control damaged, and the rate accelerating to infinity, their perceptions were no longer adequate to the psychic environment. The multiverse raced perhaps towards the creation of a new sequence of realities, perhaps towards some cold and singular conformity, perhaps towards unbridled chaos, the end of all consciousness. This last was what drew certain people to the edge of the fault, their fascination taking them step by relentless step to the brink, there to be consumed. On a dance floor swept by peculiar silhouettes and shifts of light, Boudreaux Ramzadeen, who had brought his cafe here by rail from Meridian, encouraged the Z-band to play on while he guided his tiny partners in the Cajun steps. These professional dancers travelled from all over Arcadia to join him, their hands on their swaying hips, their delicate feet performing figures as subtly intricate as the terminal's own dimensions. They danced to some other tune than the band's. Boudreaux's Neanderthal brows were drawn together in an expression of seraphic concentration as, keeping all his great bulk on his poised left foot, describing graceful steps with his right, he moved his partners with remarkable tenderness and delicacy. Jack Caraquazian deals seven hands of poker, fingering the senses of his K-play with deliberate slowness. Only here on the whole planet is there a reservoir of energy deep enough to run every machine, synthetic reasoner, or cyb in the world, but not transmittable beyond the terminal's peculiar boundaries. Only those with an incurable addiction to the past's electronic luxuries come here, and they are all gamblers of some description. Weird light saturates the table, the light of hell. He is waiting for his passion, his muse. Kalinda DeVero and Jack Caraquazian had met again across the blue. Across the blue flat sheen of a mentor-sense and linked into the wildest, riskiest game of slick image anyone had ever witnessed, let alone joined. When they came out of it, DeVero was 8 guineas up out of a betting range which had made psychic bids most seasoned players never cared to imagine. It had caused Boudreaux Ramsadine to rouse himself from his mood of ugly tolerance and insist thereafter on a stakes ceiling that would protect the metaphysical integrity of the establishment. Some of the spectators had developed peculiar psychopathic obsessions, while others had merely become subject to chronic vomiting. De Vero and Caraquasian had, however, gone into spacelessness together and did not properly emerge for 9 variations. While the walls expanded and turned at odd angles, and the colours saturated and amplified all subtleties of sensation. There is no keener experience, they say, than the act of love during a matrix shift at the Terminal Cafe. That buzz, it's self-knowledge, she told the Egyptian, holding him tight as they floated in the calm between one bizarre reality and another. Well, no disrespect, Jack, she had added. Chapter 3, Il Fait Chaud. Caraquasian found her again a year later on the Princesa du Natchez. He recognized, through her veil, her honey-coloured almond eyes. She was, she said, now ready for him. They turned their stateroom into marvellous joint quarters. Her reason for parting had been a matter of private business. That business, she warned him, was not entirely resolved, but he was grateful for even a hint of the future. The old Confederate autonomies were lucky if their matrixes were only threadbare. They were collapsing. There were constant minor reality meltdowns now, and yet there was nothing to be done but continue as if continuation were possible. Soon the Mississippi might become one of the few geographical constants. When we start to go, he said, I want to be on the river. Well, maybe chaos is already our natural condition, she had teased. She was always terrifyingly playful in the face of annihilation, whereas he found it difficult even to confront the idea. She still had a considerable amount of hope in reserve. They began to travel as brother and sister. A month after they had established this relationship, there was some question of her arrest for fraud when two well-uniformed cool boys had stepped aboard at New Auschwitz on the Arkansas side of the boat as the boat was casting off, and suddenly they had no authority. In midstream, they made threats. They insisted on entering the ballroom where she and the Egyptian were occupied, and then Caraquasian had suffered watching her raise promising eyes to the captain who saluted, asked if she had everything she needed, ordered the boys to disembark at Greenville, and said that he might stop by later to make sure that she was properly comfortable. She had told him she would greatly appreciate the attention and returned to the floor, where a lanky Z-band bounced out the old favourites. With an unsisterly flirt of her hands, she had offered herself back to her pseudo-brother. Jack Caraquasian had felt almost sour, though gentleman enough to hide it, while he took charge of the unpleasant feelings experienced by her cynical use of a sensuality he had thought, for the present at least, his preserve. Yet that sensuality was in no way diminished by its knowing employment, and his loyalty to her remained based upon profound respect, a type of love he would cheerfully have described as feminine, and through which he experienced some slight understanding of the extraordinary individual she was. He relished her lust for freedom, her optimism, her insistence on her own right to exist beyond the destruction of the universe, her willingness to achieve some form of immortality in any terms and at any cost. She thrilled him precisely because she disturbed him. He had not known such deep excitement since his last 2.5 weeks before leaving Egypt and his first 3 weeks in America, and never because of a woman. Until then, Mr. Karakwazian had enjoyed profound emotion only for the arts of gaming and his faith. His many liaisons, while frequently affectionate, had never been allowed to interfere with his abiding passion. At first he had been shocked by the realisation that he was more fascinated by Kalinda de Vero than he had ever been by the intellectual strategies of the terminal's ranks of Grand Turks. The mind, which had concentrated on gambling and its attendant skills, upon self-defense and physical fitness, upon self-control, now devoted itself almost wholly to her. He was obsessed with her thoughts, her motives, her background, her story, the effect which her reality had had upon his own. He was no longer the self-possessed individual he had been before he met her. When they had made love again that first night, he had been ready to fall in with any scheme which kept them together. Eventually, after the new Auschwitz incident, he had made some attempt to rescue his old notion of himself. But when she revealed her business had to do with a potential colour strike, valuable beyond any modern hopes, he had immediately agreed to go with her to help establish the claim. In return, she promised him a percentage of the proceeds. He committed himself to her, in spite of his not quite believing anything she told him. She had been working the boats for some while now, raising money to fund the expedition, ready to call it quits as soon as her luck turned bad. Since Memphis, her luck had run steadily down. This could also be why she had been so happy to seek an ally in him. The appearance of the Cool Boys had alarmed her, as if that evening had been the first time she had suffered any form of accusation. Besides, she told him, with the money he had, they could now easily meet the top price for the land, which was only swamp anyway. She would pay the fees and expenses. There would be no trouble raising funds once the strike was claimed. At Chickasaw, they had left the boat and set off up the trace together. She had laughed as she looked back at the levee and the princess outlined against the cold sky. "I have made an enemy, I think, of that captain." He was touched by what he perceived as her wish to reassure him of her constancy. But in Carthage, they had been drawn into a flat game, which had developed around a random hotspot no bigger than a penny, and played until the spot faded. When the debts were paid, they were down to a couple of guineas between them and had gambled their emergency batteries. At this point, superstition overwhelmed them and each had seen sudden bad luck in the other. Jack Karakwazian regretted their parting almost immediately and would have returned to her, but by the time he had heard of her again, she was already lost to Van Beek, the planter. It had been Van Beek that time who had sent his Cool Boys after her. She wrote once to Mr. Karakwazian in care of the terminal. She said she was taking a rest but would be in touch. Meanwhile, Mr. Karakwazian had a run of luck at the terminal which, had he not cheated against himself and put the winnings back into circulation, would have brought a halt to all serious gambling for a while. Jack Karakwazian now played with his back to the fault. The sight of that mighty appetite, that insatiable mystery, distracted him these days. He was impatient for her signal.